Welcome to the Federalist Society's Practice Group podcast. The following podcast, hosted by the Federalist Society's Litigation Practice Group, was recorded on Wednesday, March 22, 2017, during a live Courthouse Steps Teleforum conference call held exclusively for Federalist Society members.
Welcome to the Federalist Society's Teleforum conference call. This afternoon, we'll hear a special Courthouse Steps Teleforum on the case Microsoft v. Baker, which was heard in the Supreme Court yesterday. My name is Laura Flint. I'm the Deputy Director of Practice Groups at the Federalist Society. As always, please note that all expressions of opinion are those of the expert on today's call. Today, we are happy to have with us Corey L. Andrews, Senior Litigation Counsel at Washington Legal Foundation. I will turn it over to Corey to get us started. After opening remarks, we will go to audience question and answer. Thank you for speaking with us, Corey. The floor is yours.
Well, thank you very much, Laura, and it's always a pleasure to speak with the Federalist Society and its very informed and intelligent membership. Microsoft v. Baker is one of those cases that only a lawyer could love, I think, because it deals with very highly the very highly esoteric realm of federal appellate procedure. So at issue is whether an appellate court must review an interlocutory class certification order if the plaintiffs have voluntarily dismissed all of their claims with prejudice. Now, a little historical background may be helpful in framing the issues presented in this case, especially for those listeners who aren't sort of gurus in appellate procedure or class action appellate procedure for that matter. So class action plaintiffs have long sought the right to immediately appeal from orders denying class certification. And in the 1960s and 70s, some federal courts of appeals began allowing such an immediate right of appeal under the so-called death knell doctrine, which said if the plaintiffs could show that the denial of class certification, if left unreviewed, would end the lawsuit for all practical purposes, that they could seek an immediate appeal. So in other words, under the death knell doctrine, if plaintiffs could demonstrate that absent class certification, the value of their individual claims made it economically impractical to litigate them on their own, some federal appeals courts deemed the denial orders to be final orders under 28 U.S.C. 1291 and therefore appealable. So you can only appeal from a final order. But in 1978, in a case called Coopers and Librand versus Livesay, the United States Supreme Court unanimously rejected that practice. The court held that the death knell doctrine wasted judicial resources by encouraging inefficient, piecemeal appeals, and that it unfairly disadvantaged defendants who had no similar right to an appeal from orders granting class certification. And so following the court's unanimous holding in Livesay, Federal Rule of Appellate Procedure 23F was enacted, which gives both plaintiffs and defendants the ability to request an interlocutory appeal from a class certification order. But Rule 23F vests absolute discretion in the appeals court as to whether to grant such a review. And so many of the concerns raised first in Livesay and now embodied in Rule 23F are back before the court in Microsoft versus Baker. The case arises in the context of a putative class action against Microsoft. The class action complaint alleged that Microsoft's Xbox 360 was defectively designed because the game discs could become scratched if the game console was jostled too much. And although the named plaintiffs requested a nationwide class consisting of all owners of Xbox 360 consoles, discovery actually revealed that this was a problem reported by only 0.4% of all Xbox owners. On Microsoft's motion, the U.S. District Court for the Western District of Washington struck the plaintiffs' class allegations from the complaint, having concluded that neither causation nor damages could be proven in one stroke by common evidence. The plaintiffs then petitioned under Rule 23F to the Ninth Circuit for interlocutory review, but the appeals court denied the petition, leaving the plaintiffs to pursue their individual claims on the merits in district court. But here's where things get interesting. Rather than pursue their individual claims to finality, the plaintiffs moved to voluntarily dismiss their entire case with prejudice, declaring their intent to appeal the district court's order striking the complaint's class allegations. Although Microsoft stipulated to the dismissal, it made clear its belief that plaintiffs would have absolutely no right to appeal the court's interlocutory order on striking class allegations once that dismissal was entered. The district court granted the dismissal with prejudice and reserved to all parties their arguments as to the propriety of any appeal. So on appeal, the Ninth Circuit exercises jurisdiction, and it reversed the district court's order striking the class allegations. And so the appeals court relied on its earlier panel decision in Berger versus Home Depot, where it reasoned that in the absence of a settlement, a stipulation that leads to a dismissal with prejudice does not destroy adversity in the judgment that's necessary to support an appeal of a class certification denial. And so for that reason, the Ninth Circuit said, the plaintiff's voluntary dismissal tactic created a final judgment giving the appeals court jurisdiction to decide whether certification was properly denied. Then the Ninth Circuit went on to hold that the district court had abused its discretion when it struck the class allegation in the complaint. And it relied on a 2010 decision in which the court had concluded that it doesn't matter whether the defect alleged by plaintiffs may never manifest or if it manifests for different reasons for different users, because typicality under Rule 23 can be satisfied even under highly unique factual circumstances. But the panel ultimately expressed, quote, no opinion, end quote, on whether the plaintiff should prevail on a motion for class certification, but instead it remanded the case for further proceedings for the district court to determine the viability of plaintiff's proposed class once again. Now, the 3rd, 4th, 7th, 10th, and 11th circuits have all rejected this approach, and they hold unequivocally that a named plaintiff's dismissal with prejudice of her individual claims following an interlocutory adverse class certification order is not a final appealable order. So on the basis of that circuit split, the Supreme Court granted cert, and when it did so, it added a second question for the parties to address in their merits briefing. And that question was whether jurisdiction exists even under Article III's case or controversy requirement, given that all the claims were voluntarily dismissed with prejudice. So on the merits, Microsoft advanced several arguments as to why the Ninth Circuit's view should be rejected. As Microsoft frames it, either plaintiff's voluntary dismissal lacks finality under 28 U.S.C. 1291 because the plaintiffs can resume litigating their claims without the benefit of any appellate decision relating to the merits of those claims, or the case is moot because the plaintiff's claims cannot under any circumstances spring back to life. They were forever extinguished when they were voluntarily dismissed with prejudice. So pick your poison, Microsoft is basically saying. As a preliminary matter, this case no longer presents a justiciable case or controversy because the plaintiffs voluntarily dismissed all of their claims with prejudice, rendering any appeal moot. Microsoft goes on to say neither party contends that the district court erred in entering its final judgment disposing of the action with prejudice. In fact, the plaintiffs specifically requested it, and, well, Microsoft very wisely agreed to it. And as a result of that invited dismissal, or almost you might say that invited error, if you will, to which all parties stipulated, Article III's adversity requirement is utterly lacking, and a live dispute between the parties no longer exists to support federal jurisdiction, appellate, or otherwise. But then Microsoft says even assuming if Article III is somehow satisfied, the panel's holding hits up against the court's decision in LiveSay, which again held that allowing a plaintiff to appeal a class certification denial immediately as of right rather than from a final judgment after an adverse trial on the merits violates Congress's longstanding policy against multiple piecemeal appeals. Those appeals are impermissible, LiveSay explained, even when the denial of class certification tolls the death knell for the plaintiff's entire class, an entire case. And if that weren't enough, Microsoft points out that the panel's expansive reading of 28 U.S.C. 1291 is wholly inconsistent with the proper understanding of Federal Rule 23F, which again grants both plaintiffs and defendants the right to request an interlocutory review of class certification orders. But it provides the appeals courts with the absolute unreviewable discretion to deny that request. And so if the court were to actually adopt the reasoning of the Ninth Circuit, Rule 23F would be rendered a dead letter. Appeals courts would no longer be left with discretion. They would have these appeals foisted upon them. The plaintiff's response is that a final judgment is always a final decision, and that the case is over when there's nothing left for the district court to do. And that's the case here. The mere fact that the final judgment is manufactured doesn't mean it isn't final for purposes of appellate jurisdiction. Plaintiffs also argue that the real possibility of appellate reversal on appeal has no bearing on whether the case is final or not. Otherwise, no judgment would ever be final. And then the plaintiffs argue that their voluntary dismissal was somehow conditioned on their intention to appeal the case. So the court held oral argument yesterday, and Peter Strist argued the case for the plaintiffs, and the bottom line is that the justices clearly were not buying what he was selling. Almost to the person, they expressed great skepticism, very dubious that this voluntary dismissal tactic can accomplish what the plaintiffs want it to. Some interesting quotes from oral argument. Justice Kagan, this was to Microsoft's counsel, Jeff Fisher. She said, "It does seem to me like you have an awfully good argument. Why did people in the Ninth Circuit think that this was the governing law?" She seemed almost incredulous that this was a practice that someone thought was an appropriate practice. Justice Sotomayor said, "I haven't been able to imagine a situation in which a case is dismissed with prejudice, but where there may be some issues that should survive." Justice Breyer, who I think clearly thought this was nonsense, said, "You're in a dilemma," to the counsel for plaintiffs. "If you say I condition my dismissal upon my late appealing, you run into our case law, which says that the judgment is final. But if you haven't reserved something, then you're in the box you're in right now, and the case is over." And I think it's clear that many of the justices think the box that the plaintiffs are in right now is one of mootness, where the case is over. Justice Ginsburg, for her part, went on to explain that the rulemakers went through a lot of trouble to figure out what to do with an interlocutory ruling on class actions, and it came up with Rule 23F, which is you litigate those individual claims to finality. This device, she says, seems to be just a way to get around Rule 23F. And Chief Justice Roberts perhaps put it not too fine a point on it when he said, "The reversal you're looking for doesn't go to the merits of the judgment that you asked for. Nothing that you're arguing on appeal is going to change the fact that you lose." And so whereas a lot of Supreme Court arguments leave one to wonder about the outcome, I think this one, the outcome is pretty fairly predictable, pretty fairly certain. Justice Sotomayor, for her part, did seem interested in trying to think of a more, as she put it, a more flexible rule. She said she doesn't like bright line finalities, and she was interested in looking into a Second Circuit case that held something similar to what the Ninth Circuit's rule is, to see some of the reasoning behind it there. But even she seemed highly dubious of the plaintiff's case. And so I'd be surprised if, with all the usual disclaimers that we don't know and that oral argument doesn't really isn't a good indicator, I would be surprised if Microsoft doesn't prevail in this case. And that's what I expect to happen when the court issues its opinion later on this term.
Let's go to audience questions. In a moment, you'll hear a prompt indicating that the floor mode has been turned on. After that, to request the floor, enter star, then the pound key. When we get to your request, you will hear a prompt, and then you may ask your question. We will answer questions in the order in which they are received. Again, to ask a question, please enter star, then the pound key on your telephone keypad. We'll go to our first question.
Hi. I guess my question is really about the Ninth Circuit. I mean, it almost sounds like they think that they got it wrong in the first decision, even though they say they have no opinion. If they really thought these guys deserved a chance, I mean, is there any explanation from the second panel at the Ninth Circuit about that first decision?
There's a few ways to interpret your question. Are you talking about the Rule 23F panel and then the subsequent panel?
Yes.
Yeah, so those are two different panels. And ironically enough, there is a member of the second panel who was on the first panel. And, you know, because of the way appellate courts operate, and particularly when they're sitting as a court of discretion and not as a court of right, I mean, there are any number of reasons why you might imagine that an appellate court would say, we don't want to hear your case yet. Maybe they think they peeked at the merits and they don't think there's any merits to the case. Maybe they think, well, the district court may fix this or they may sort it out even if they thought it was wrong, but we don't want to waste our resources on it. So when you're getting hit with 23Fs, I think the approval rate or the grant for 23F petitions in the Ninth Circuit is around 20%. So they grant about one out of every five. But, you know, it's certainly possible that they see something that they think is wrong, but they say, you know, we can clean that up later or it'll sort itself out. And maybe that's what they were thinking. I don't know. But they certainly, as you say, the two panels came to two completely different decisions.
Our floor is wide open. To ask a question, please enter star, then the pound key on your telephone keypad. I'll make a brief announcement. Our next telephone conference call is scheduled for tomorrow, Thursday, March 23rd. That call will feature a post-decision recap of the Supreme Court case Pena-Rodriguez v. Colorado. That call will feature John Richter, partner at King & Spalding. Again, to ask a question, please enter star, then the pound key on your telephone keypad. While we wait for a question to line up, I'll ask one of my own. Besides the legal arguments here, are there any important policy considerations?
Yes, there are. I mean, you're right. I think most of the court's argument was focused, and even the briefing was focused on the legal arguments. But there are some policy arguments here, and one of them, interestingly, didn't even come up at argument. It wasn't raised by any of the justices, and surprisingly, in some ways, it wasn't even brought up by Microsoft's attorney. But that's the inherent unfairness to defendants of a rule like this, right? So if you go back to Livesay reminded us that, hey, plaintiffs aren't the only people for whom a class certification decision is very important. It could render the death knell for a class action defense, which is, as we all know, usually what happens once the class action is certified. The overwhelming leverage it gives to seek a settlement is enormous and usually cannot be resisted. And so here, if plaintiffs are clearly the only people who can seek a voluntary dismissal with prejudice, the defendants can't do that. And so it's a way to get an interlocutory issue reviewed that the plaintiffs enjoy and the defendants don't. And that's just, fundamentally unfair. The other more, perhaps even more important policy decision, and I think this is one that I think Justice Alito did allude to in his questioning, is there's nothing about the Ninth Circuit's rule that cabins this kind of gimmick to class certification orders, right? So since there's nothing about it that is unique to class cert, what about a plaintiff who doesn't like a discovery order or a sanctions order? Or what about an important evidentiary order, a motion in limine? Or you can imagine some sort of Daubert hearing goes off the rails and they don't like that. I mean, there's it's a real Pandora's box, in terms of if you're going to allow plaintiffs to use this little gimmick to appeal from interlocutory matters that don't go to the merits, there's a lot of interlocutory matters that might be litigated. And you could even imagine them all being sent, you know, up to the appeals court in the same case, which is, again, exactly the kind of piecemeal wasting of judicial resources that Congress and the Supreme Court have made clear time and time again the rules are intended to prevent. And then on top of that, imagine the additional cost of all of those appeals, right? You're going to go up to the Ninth Circuit again and again, and this case is a perfect example. So under the Ninth Circuit's reading, you know, the Ninth Circuit says, "Hey, we're not saying that you have to certify the class. We're just saying that we didn't like what you did. We're going to send it back down for you to reconsider." Let's say the district court does exactly the same thing and strikes the class allegations. Are the plaintiffs then again going to be able to dismiss their claims and go right back up to the Ninth Circuit to relitigate it yet again on the other grounds that the district court based its decision on? I mean, at some point, just interest of judicial resources and finality come into play that I think is one of the reasons why there was such apparent unanimity on the part of the court yesterday.
Again, to ask a question, please enter star, then the pound key on your telephone keypad. A reminder to keep an eye out for emails announcing upcoming telephone calls, and you can also consult the full schedule of our upcoming calls on the Federalist Society's website. Also available there are podcasts of previously recorded telephone calls you may have missed. To ask a question, please enter star, then the pound key on your telephone keypad. While we wait, we have another audience question. Mm-hmm.
It seems to me that when you're talking about class actions, the plaintiffs are such a diverse or dispersed group of people that the law firm that seeks to represent them, the only reason they could do it is because it's a class action. They can't possibly collect all these thousands of people who are the usual plaintiffs in a class action suit and seek to represent them all individually. And so the plaintiff is not the usual plaintiff who is bound by the action of his attorney because he's controlling the attorney. This is a diverse plaintiff that wouldn't have any rights without the law firm coming in and trying to acquire them. Also, the idea that dismissal with prejudice is necessarily final. One of the reasons the Texaco case went forward, that destroyed Texaco with the decision, was that in Maryland, dismissal with prejudice is not with prejudice. It's kind of like New York having a Supreme Court that's the lowest court in its system.
Thanks for your thoughts. Yeah, of course, this is a case under federal law, so under the federal rules, Rule 41, dismissal with prejudice is final. But going back to your earlier point, you know, this is just another version of the same argument that the plaintiffs made in LiveSafe. This is what the death knell doctrine was all about, right? This has been around since the 60s and 70s. It's economically impracticable for us to litigate our claims individually. Therefore, make a special case for us. And in this case, it's interesting to point out, actually, it's not always economically impractical. For example, the statutes that the suit against Microsoft was brought under in this case provides for attorney's fees. It has a fees provision. So presumably, the attorneys could be reimbursed all of the fees for their work on the case if they were to proceed to the merits. And the LiveSafe case itself, ironically, which was a similar kind of case, if you follow the history of what happened after LiveSafe, after the Supreme Court said no, you have to go back down and basically litigate to finality, the case ended up settling for $1.3 million. And so it's not always the case that a case that's brought as a class action is as economically infeasible or, you know, impracticable to be brought individually. It just depends on the individual case. But again, the court in LiveSay took that argument into consideration. The Rules Committee took that argument into consideration, and they decided that this this regime under 23F, where you give the court's discretion to review it, and if they don't, you litigate to finality, that was the best bargain.
Again, to ask a question, please enter star, then the pound key on your telephone keypad. While we wait for another question, I'll ask one of my own. This case has been kind of unusual because cert was granted in January 2016, and it hasn't been heard until now. Why do you think it took so long to grant oral argument?
You know, there's a lot of people who would like to know the answer to that question. It would only be speculation, but you know, as you say, this case was granted early last year, beginning of last year. We finally had argument. I think it was more than 2 years after the Ninth Circuit's opinion, and almost 4.5 years after the district court's order. So it is very unusual. I mean, for the longest time, I think the people thought, well, the reason the court is pushing it off to the, you know, not only later in last term's calendar, but then on to this term's calendar, but it didn't schedule it last fall, it pushed it into the spring, was that they were divided 4-4. I mean, that seemed to be sort of one of the more operating assumptions, which was shocking given the case, and is obviously unfounded after yesterday's oral argument. They weren't divided. I suppose another possibility is that they were divided on the grounds for their decision, that perhaps four of the justices think the claims are moot, and four of the justices think the claims are not final because the dismissal didn't render them moot, or, you know, wasn't with prejudice entirely, that they could somehow spring back. And I guess the only other thought would be if it was a unanimous case all along, maybe the court was thinking, let's welcome our ninth justice into the fold with a nice case that everyone can agree on. So those are sort of the three theories that are kicking around. I don't know which one is the best, and chances are probably good that we'll never know the answer.
I'll make a final call for questions. To ask a question, please enter star, then the pound key on your telephone keypad. Not seeing any more questions, would you like to make any final remarks?
Sure. Just kind of, you know, recapping the case. years after LiveSay, the Rules Committee considered what options should be available to plaintiffs who find themselves in precisely the situation the plaintiffs here claim to have found themselves, having class certification denied in a case where they claim that the individual claims make it impractical to litigate ahead on an individualized basis. But in the system that the Rules Committee adopted and that the Supreme Court endorsed in Rule 23F, the plaintiff's theory with the voluntary dismissal tactic they wish to use would completely upend the carefully considered rule, which allows for a discretionary review of those interlocutory orders. And the plaintiff's theory would also contravene the statutory and the case law on which the rule is based. So I'm not surprised that the overwhelming majority of the court were highly dubious of the case the plaintiffs were making, and I anticipate there'll be a lot of agreement when the order comes out, when the opinion comes out later this term, reversing the Ninth Circuit. So thanks to everyone for calling in.
On behalf of the Federalist Society, I want to thank our expert for the benefit of his valuable time and expertise today. We welcome listener feedback by email at info@fedsoc.org. Thank you all for joining us. We are adjourned.
Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed this Practice Group podcast. For materials related to this podcast and other Federalist Society multimedia, please visit the Federalist Society's website at fedsoc.org/multimedia.